In this session, we need to finish up Daniel chapter 2, which we got partially through last time. And I'll just bring you up to speed real quick here. In the beginning of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had a dream. Oh, could I have one of those? I didn't even say myself one of those things. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Thanks. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, which he professed to have forgotten when he woke up. Now, he may have indeed forgotten it. If so, he remembered it again when Daniel described it, and that is a possibility. Or else he may not have forgotten it, and he just wanted to test his astrologers and wise men, because upon awaking from his dream, he called all of his counselors and said, "I've had a dream. I want you to tell me what the dream was and what it means." And they said, "Well, just tell us the dream. We'll be glad to tell you what it means." And he says, "No, I want you to tell me what the dream was and tell me what it means, so that I'll know that I can trust what you claim that it means. You'll show that you actually have insights worth trusting." And they were unable to do this. They said, "No king has ever asked such things of anyone, of his counselors, and this is unfair." And Nebuchadnezzar says, "Well, you guys are a bunch of phonies. Off with your heads." So the news got around that all the wise men of Babylon were going to be killed, and that would affect Daniel and his three friends too, who for some reason were not called in initially. It's possible because they were sort of rookies. They had just finished their 3 years of training in the language of the Chaldeans, and they were not maybe in the first ranks. They weren't the first string of the counselors that were called in on those situations, but because the older ones who had been there longer were unsuccessful, it was probably assumed that the younger guys weren't any better. But when Daniel heard from Arioch, the man who had been sent to kill all the wise men, what this was about, he said, "Well, tell the king, we'll give him the answer." And so Daniel was given some time. As near as we can tell, it only took one night. And in the night visions, I believe it was, God gave Daniel the interpretation. We've read some of the verses. We've read the verses where he told the dream to Nebuchadnezzar. We have not yet read the verses where he interpreted the dream. I'd like, since there's been some passage of time since we read the verses where he describes the dream, to take those verses again. We'll start at verse 24. And go to the end of the chapter. "Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, 'I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation.'" Notice Arioch takes credit for having located him, like he went on a diligent search and finally, through his own investigative genius, was able to locate somebody who could do this, where in fact, of course, he had just come to kill Daniel, and Daniel had volunteered his services in this capacity. So Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, "I have found a man." Oh, we already read that. "And king answered and said to Daniel," whose name was Belteshazzar. You remember that was his Babylonian name given to him when he was taken into captivity. "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation of the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart." So again, Daniel does not claim to be superior to those who have been incapable of doing what he's doing. He gives all the credit to God, and he says the reason that God has revealed it to me is so that my life would be spared, me and my friends, and also so that you'd know what it was God was trying to tell you through this dream you had. Verse 31, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, a statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, and its legs of iron. its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now, without having read the interpretation, we can just take a look for a moment at the details of the dream. The dream was of, it would appear, a human image. It does not specify that it was human, but it stands seemingly erect like a human, so we'll just assume that this is a statue of a man. We know that in the next chapter, in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar himself made a statue of a man. Some would say even a statue of himself, though it doesn't specify that. It was all of gold, though, I believe, and it was commanded that all people should worship it. There is no necessary reason to believe that this statue in chapter 3 was modeled after the one he saw in the dream, although the nearness of the two chapters to each other may give that impression, that maybe because of this statue in the dream he was impressed with it so much he wanted to make an image like that and make it an object of worship. That would be perhaps deducing from too little evidence, more than what is stated or even implied. But he saw, as it would appear, a human image. This becomes necessary to assume later on when we consider especially the dispensational interpretation, which makes a great deal of the toes of the image. Because assuming the image is of a human form, that would mean it has 10 toes, unless it was a mutant human. Most humans have 10 toes. And the dispensational position, because of its the peculiarities of its approach to this passage, thinks those 10 toes are important. Although the passage doesn't mention toes or 10, I mean, it does mention feet and toes, but it doesn't mention the number of the toes. The assumption that there are 10 toes is simply from the assumption that this is a human figure, and that is likely the case. Now, the metals from which this was made descend in value from the head as you move toward the feet. Gold is obviously the most valuable of the metals named. It's also a very soft and not a very strong metal. Silver comes next, which is of somewhat less value than gold. I don't know whether silver is stronger than gold. I don't know enough about metallurgy to know if that's the case, but whether it is or not, the point is made that the silver is not as valuable as the gold. Then you've got bronze as you move down, which is considerably less valuable, stronger than silver. And then you've got iron, which is stronger still, but less value still. So as you go down from the head to toward the feet, the general trend is toward metals of less value but greater strength. Less glory, perhaps we could say, but greater strength. And in the end, the legs have a mixture, and the feet have a mixture of iron and clay. And then, now, by the way, iron and clay do not stick together well, and that is a point brought up later on in the interpretation, so that you find that the image in its feet is somewhat brittle, unstable. Its components will not hold together real well. Now, the final vision, final part of this dream, was of a stone. I've always pictured the stone flying through the air, though it doesn't, I guess, specifically state that, but a stone comes. It is not made with hands. Now, it is stated that the stone is not made with hands to contrast with the other metals, the other minerals that are there. All of the other minerals, since they are in the shape of a statue, clearly have been molded by human hands, or at least that is the impression. When you see an image, a statue made of metal, you know that there's been some kind of a smith at work or a sculptor. The human hands have constructed it. Whereas the stone, this final mineral element in the vision, is not made with hands. And of course, this suggests it's of divine origin rather than of human origin. And this stone strikes the image in the feet, which causes the collapse of the whole thing. And then the image, two things seem to happen at once. I don't think I'm reading too much into it. We read of two things happening. My impression is that they happen somewhat simultaneously. The stone that struck the image in the feet grows. It grows from what is, I think it is implied, small initially, to a huge mountain that fills the whole earth. Apparently, concurrent with that growth of that stone, there is a crushing into powder into fine powder of the metals from which the image was made, so that they are finally blown away like chaff from the summer threshing floor. So this stone grows, and the metals are ground small and eventually disappear. And it doesn't say exactly how sudden this growth is or how protracted, but the growth of the stone into great mountain seems to, at least it takes some time. It might only take a few moments, or it might take a very long time. We're not told how lengthy the process is, but in time the stone has displaced all the metals of the image. Now the interpretation is given, beginning at verse 36. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of the gold. You are this head of gold in the image. Now, to say that Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold, it may speak of him as an individual, or other details that will come up later may determine whether it actually refers to him not personally, but as the representative of the nation or the empire of Babylon. Many, I think most, understand it in the latter sense, that Nebuchadnezzar, it's not the man himself, but his empire is the head of gold of this image. We'll look at several different theories about that before we're done today. Verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. Just like silver is inferior to gold, so the kingdom that would follow is going to be inferior to him. So we now realize that these metals represent kingdoms. In fact, from this verse it would appear that these metals represent successive kingdoms. They're not just different kingdoms, but they're kingdoms that will succeed one another. Babylon will fall, the head of gold, and will be replaced by an inferior kingdom, which is represented by the chest of silver. And then it says another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. So we are not given the names of the silver or the bronze kingdom by Daniel. Only the Babylonian kingdom is named, or Nebuchadnezzar, to be more precise. Then we have a fourth kingdom in verse 40. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with the ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with the clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Now, we are going to, of course, consider the meaning of this interpretation and the identity of these kingdoms. Before we do, though, I just want to pick up the last four verses of the chapter to show how Nebuchadnezzar reacted, obviously recognizing the dream as Daniel told it, as the genuine dream such as he had really had, and therefore having reason to trust the interpretation as well. The king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him, which we do not read of Daniel rejecting, but I guess the Jew, even the uncompromised Jew, could either be silent in a situation like that or object. Now, when Peter visited the house of Cornelius and all those people bowed down to him, and he rebuked them and told them to get up off their faces. Likewise, when John saw the vision on Patmos, he twice fell down and almost worshipped the angel that was showing him, and he was rebuked for that. Daniel may have felt like I'm not sure what Daniel may have felt like about that, but he may have actually said no. He may have waved it away, and we don't read of his reaction to it. I'm sure that Daniel would not have been comfortable with them offering incense to him, though he may have felt it was not his place to give orders to the king what he could or could not do in this respect. He may have just endured it. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over the wise men of Babylon. This is so much like what happened to Joseph when he correctly interpreted Pharaoh's dream. He was given rulership over all the land of Egypt. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. This seems to mean that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were given some kind of positions of authority, not equivalent to that of Daniel. Daniel sitting in the gate of the king seems like he was perhaps the chief magistrate. When people wished to approach the king, they'd have to go through Daniel, in all likelihood. Now, back in chapter 1, that chapter closed by telling of Daniel and his friends being brought before Nebuchadnezzar after 3 years of training in the language of the Chaldeans. And in verse 20 of chapter 1, it says, "In all the matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm." Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Daniel continued, apparently, in the service of the king, both the kings of Babylon and of later of Persia, after Babylon fell to Persia. But not always in the same capacity. Initially, he and his friends were just wise counselors and recognized to be superior to the others. But eventually, he was actually given political status, and he sat in the gate of the king. He was sort of like a chancellor or something. Who knows what the right title would be for him. But it's very remarkably similar to the case of Joseph, a Jewish boy in a Gentile land who was given prominence by the sovereignty of God, really, by giving him the only ability to answer the king's mystery of his dream. Now, of course, it's a matter of interest, I think, to us, it should be, what these kingdoms are that are not identified by name. There are 4 kingdoms, or 5, really, maybe even 6. We know there are 4 that are numbered. The head of gold is the first, the chest of silver is the second, the belly of bronze is the third, the legs of iron are the 4th. Beyond that, we don't read of a 5th, 6th, and so forth. They are numbered up to that point, up to verse 40, the 4th kingdom. We don't read of, and the 5th and the 6th. It depends on whether we regard the feet to be yet another kingdom. Because the legs are of iron, but the feet and the ankles are of iron and clay. Does this represent a 5th kingdom? Some view it something like that. Now, also, of course, the stone that struck the image in the feet, it is specifically said to be a kingdom. It says in verse 44, "In the days of these kings, the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed." Now, that is represented by the stone. So we know there's at least 5 kingdoms. There are the 4 that are listed, plus there is the kingdom of God. The God of heaven sets up a kingdom. The others are not enumerated, and most scholars have felt that the feet are simply an extension of the 4th kingdom, that they belong to the 4th kingdom, and it is not a 5th and separate entity. Now, there is agreement among evangelicals on at least one point. In fact, most conservative evangelicals agree on most points of interpretation. There are liberals who hold different views than the evangelicals hold on this, but certainly almost all agree that the 5th kingdom, which is the Messiah's kingdom, or the stone, is the Messiah's kingdom. The Messiah is not mentioned by name here. It doesn't specify the Messiah, but it does say the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. Taken together with the many kingdom prophecies of the Old Testament prophets and their specific link to the Messiah himself as king, it would be hard to avoid the conclusion that this is the Messianic kingdom being established here under Jesus, the Messiah. But the question is, what about the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th kingdoms? What are they? Well, evangelicals have basically had a consensus among themselves about this from the early church fathers, including Irenaeus and Origen and Eusebius and Jerome and up through Augustine and Luther and Calvin and most conservatives today, including dispensationalists today, Darby and Schofield, they all pretty much have the same opinion about what the first, second, third, and fourth kingdom represent. There are, however, other opinions, and I want to consider the other opinions first. I don't agree with the other opinions, but I want to consider them so that we can just dispense with them as possibilities. I told you earlier that Daniel is, of all the books of the Old Testament, probably more than any other, the proving ground of controversy over the supernatural origin of Scripture. It is certainly pivotal in deciding whether prophecy is indeed supernatural or not, whether the prophets of the Old Testament were indeed capable of seeing into the future by divine insight. Modernists and theological liberals, generally speaking, do not believe in the supernatural. There may be some who have some belief in some supernatural, I'm not sure, but the tendency is to discredit all supernatural things, all the miracles in the Bible, and all prophecy. And therefore, Daniel is a stumbling block to them, because Daniel is one of the has some of the most specific predictive prophecy of any book of the Bible. That is, if Daniel wrote it in the 6th century B.C., as the book itself claims to be true. What liberals have generally done to eliminate the element of supernatural prophecy from the book of Daniel is to late date the book. I told you this in our introduction to the book of Daniel. The average liberal opinion is that the book was written considerably later than Daniel's time, 300-400 years after Daniel's time, in the time of the Maccabean revolt. And it is thought that the book of Daniel does not accurately predict anything beyond the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I don't know how much we've talked about Antiochus Epiphanes this year in other classes. I'll just give you the nutshell version here. After Babylon fell, you recall the Jews, having been in Babylon as captives for 70 years, were released by Cyrus, the Persian ruler. And they went. Many of them went back to Jerusalem and rebuilt the city and the temple. Many didn't. Some stayed in the Persian Empire. Later on, the Persian Empire fell to the Greek Empire. Now, this was in the time of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire. Alexander didn't live very long, though. It took him 12 years to conquer the world, as he knew it. And then, and he started at age 20. So at age 32 or 33, he died. Various theories have been put forward as to the cause of Alexander's death. Some say he died of venereal disease. Some say he died drunk. There might be any number of things all true about his death. But the point, some say he died because he had no more worlds to conquer and didn't want to live anymore. Lots of theories exist about Alexander and his death, but one thing is known, he died young. He conquered the world in 12 years and then died. When he died, his two sons were assassinated so that they could not succeed him to power. And he had four generals who fought among themselves, each of them hoping to replace him. Each one hoped to become the next emperor of the world after Alexander. They wanted to be the successor. None of the four, however, were successful. None of them were powerful enough to supplant the other three. So finally, by agreement, these four men divided up the empire that had been that of Alexander. This continued to be the Greek Empire, but it was ruled by four men who had been generals. History usually refers to them as the Diadochi, or Diadochoi. I'm not sure of the exact meaning of Diadochoi, but It's usually the term that is used of the successors of Alexander, the four men, the four generals who took over his empire. And these four men ruled different portions of what had been Alexander's empire. Two of them in particular become significant in biblical history because Seleucus, one of them, ruled the region above Israel, which is Syria. And Ptolemy, another one of them, ruled the region below Israel, which is Egypt. And these two kings fought with each other, and whenever they fought with each other, they had to go through Israel, and Israel suffered a great deal under them. And for the first 100 years after Alexander's time, Israel was under the Ptolemies in Egypt. After that, the Seleucid dynasty ruled them, and there was a lot of banding about between these two and a lot of wars. Finally, one of the Seleucid kings whose name was Antiochus the Fourth, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, sacrificed a pig on an altar to Zeus in the Jewish temple and so forth. And shortly after that, some other developments led to a war, a revolt on the part of the Jews called the Maccabean Revolt. And I don't know how much you're familiar with that. We'll have more to say about it later because Daniel has more to say about it. But it was during the time of the Maccabean Revolt that the Jews finally won their independence briefly until the Roman Empire came along and took over that region. I think it was around 63 BC that the Romans brought Palestine into their dominion. Time of Antiochus was about 100 years before that, 167, 168 BC. So here's the sequence of events from Daniel's time. The Babylonian Empire was conquered by Cyrus and the Persians. The Persian Empire later was conquered by Alexander the Great and the Greeks. When Alexander died, four men divided up his Greek empire, and the Diadochoi, as they were called, ruled the world, essentially. Israel was sometimes under the control of one and sometimes under the control of another, of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And they won their independence in the days of the Maccabees, about 170 years before Christ. But about 63 BC, they came under Roman dominion, which, of course, they were still under at the time of the birth of Jesus and of his crucifixion. Jesus was crucified by Romans. So that's how that history between the time of Daniel and Christ measures up. Now, the problem here is, if Daniel is in fact talking about the time of Christ and the Roman Empire, the liberal doesn't know how to handle that. Because that the Roman Empire rose after the time that they believe Daniel lived. They believe Daniel lived around the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, almost 200 years before Christ, and about 100 years before the Romans came to power. So the Fourth Empire, which most evangelicals have always understood to be the Roman Empire, is thought to be something else. The liberal cannot make the Fourth Kingdom in Daniel to be the Roman Empire, because they don't believe that it was written late enough in time to anticipate the Roman Empire, and they don't believe in predictive prophecy. So almost all of them make the Fourth Empire the Grecian Empire, one way or another. They figure, you know, if Daniel was written during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the writer would know about the Grecian Empire because he would have lived in the tail end of that period. But there's a problem with that, because if Babylon is the first kingdom and Greece is the fourth kingdom, you need to find some way to make two kingdoms in between the first and the fourth. You've got to have a second and a third. But historically, the Media-Persian Empire was the only empire between that of Babylon and that of Greece. Now, there are three ways that I'm aware of. There may be others, but there are three principal ways in which those who are looking to make the fourth kingdom be the Grecian Empire have sorted this out. Probably the most common way that this is done by liberal scholars is to say, okay, Babylon is the head of gold, and Greece is the legs of iron. Now, as far as the chest of silver and the belly of bronze are concerned, these are Media and Persia, respectively. The chest of silver would be Media, and the belly of bronze is Persia. Now, there's a problem here. Of course, evangelicals have always understood the chest of silver to be Media-Persia. The Medians and the Persians were two different ethnic groups, but they joined in power prior to the fall of Babylon. And when Babylon fell, it fell to the Media-Persian Empire, or what would be called Medo-Persia. There never was an independent Median kingdom after the fall of Babylon. Now, the scholars know this, but they don't care because they think that the writer of Daniel was mistaken about this. Yes? Well, they don't believe... Well, how does a liberal make the Bible relevant? I haven't a clue. I mean, I don't even know why they go into theology as a profession, because they don't believe the Bible. Many of them don't even believe in God. The guys of the Jesus Seminar, for example, who've gotten a lot of publicity, all of them are leading New Testament scholars in universities and seminaries, but not a lot of them don't even believe God exists, much less Jesus. You know? You wonder, why do these guys go into theology as a profession? I don't know, but as far as its relevance, they would just say it's the book of Daniel is not prophecy. It is an interesting artifact of Jewish literature, you know, produced during the Maccabean period, and you know, trying to convince the Jews that all of this was prophesied a long time ago by some fictional character named Daniel. Yes, they don't believe Daniel ever existed. They believe that some anonymous writer wrote it and pretended to be someone who lived back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. So that's how the liberals understand that, generally. Now, as I said, it's impossible for the four kingdoms to be Babylon, Media, second, Persia, third, and Greece, fourth, because there was no Median Empire after the Babylonian Empire, separate from the Persian. Now, as I said, the scholars know this, but they think that the writer of Daniel didn't know this. They think that the writer of Daniel was historically inaccurate, that he knew something about the Medes, knew something about the Persians, and mistakenly thought that the Median Empire was separate from the Persian Empire, and therefore that the writer of Daniel, who made all this up, of course, in their opinion, mistakenly thought that there were two kingdoms between that of Babylon and that of Greece, when in fact there was just the Media Persian. Now, first of all, I guess we could ask, did the writer of Daniel think that way? We know that history tells that if he did, he was wrong. But did the writer of Daniel believe that the Median Empire was separate from the Persian, or did he believe in the Media Persian Empire, just like modern scholars know to be the facts? Well, you can look, if you'd like, at Daniel chapter 5 and verse 28, and here we read of Daniel interpreting the writing on the wall to Belshazzar at the evening that Babylon fell. In Daniel 5:28, he's interpreting the meaning of the mystical words Mene Tekel Upharsin, which appeared on the wall, and with reference to the last, he says, Perez, your kingdom has been divided. Perez is a word that means divided. And it's very similar in sound to the word for Persians in the same language. It says, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now, this is the night of the fall of Babylon. He doesn't say it's given to the Medes, and someday when the Medes fall, they'll be replaced by the Persians. Daniel told Belshazzar, your kingdom is falling tonight, and it's given over to the Medes and the Persians. That is the Media-Persian Empire, the Media-Persian rulers. Likewise, in chapter 6, under Darius, the man who put Daniel in the lion's den, who was one of the early rulers, very possibly the first ruler before Cyrus showed up in Babylon, we're not sure who Darius was, but we can see, for example, in chapter 6 and verse 8, that the counselors of the king said, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. The laws of the Medes and Persians. The writer of Daniel obviously knew that the Medes and the Persians were a joined entity, that they were one kingdom, not two. Of course, that's historically correct, but all that this shows is that the scholars are wrong who think that Daniel didn't know this, or that the author of Daniel didn't know this. Obviously, the author Daniel knew about the Medes and Persians being one kingdom that replaced Babylon, which rules out entirely the possibility that he thought the Medes were the second empire and the Persians the third, and then that would make Greece the fourth. So, in my opinion, this liberal view is simply without foundation. The only thing that really gives it any strength is the conviction that Daniel couldn't have written this in the 6th century B.C. because he couldn't possibly have known, and there's no such thing as predictive prophecy. That being the starting point for liberal scholarship, they have to come up with something that really doesn't work to fit this in. Now, there are some other suggestions that have been made. I don't even think these have always been by liberals, though they have been somewhat different than the average consensus of evangelicals. I have here in this chart that I've given you the view of Stuart, who believed that the head of gold represented Babylon, and that the chest of silver represented Media Persia. Now, that in that, he agrees with evangelical consensus. Media Persia is the second kingdom, the chest of silver. But the third and fourth he makes out to be Alexander and Alexander's successors, respectively. So Alexander would be the third kingdom himself, the third king. And then his successors, the Diadochoi, would be the fourth kingdom. Now, the reason that this view simply is untenable is because we have the same lineup of four kingdoms in Daniel chapter 7. And we're specifically told that they are four kingdoms beginning with Babylon. just like Daniel chapter 2 has. In Daniel 2, we have the dream of Nebuchadnezzar with the image and the four metals. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel himself has a dream. And in that dream, he sees rising from the sea four animals. And he is later told that these animals represent four successive empires, the first being Babylon. Well, you've got, obviously, it's got to be the same four. In Daniel 2, there's four. The first one's Babylon. In Daniel 7, there's four. And the first one's Babylon. Therefore, you have a first, a second, a third, and a fourth kingdom in both passages. And scholars are fairly well agreed, for the most part, that they are the same four. Now, if you check out the fourth kingdom in Daniel chapter 7, there are things said about it that simply could not apply to Alexander's successors. And on Stuart's view, the fourth kingdom in Daniel chapter 2 refers to the Diadochoi, the four generals who took over Alexander's kingdom. But that simply can't apply if you try to apply the fourth kingdom in chapter 7 to that. The fourth kingdom tramples the whole world. It is emphasized three times in Daniel 7 that the fourth kingdom will be diverse from all the others. It'll stand out from like a sore thumb. It'll be in a class by itself. But in what sense could the rule of the successors of Alexander be said to be so emphatically diverse from that of Alexander and those before him? It's just not applicable. And so Stuart's view is hardly to be credited. One other view that I don't agree with, I'd like to suggest, and I'd like to talk about the more evangelical views. A scholar named Hitzig had the view that the first kingdom, or the first king, the head of gold, is Nebuchadnezzar himself. Now, this, of all the views we're considering, this is the only one that considers that the head of gold is only the man, Nebuchadnezzar, as opposed to the whole Babylonian Empire. But he considers the first kingdom to be Nebuchadnezzar, and the second to be Belshazzar. Now, Belshazzar was the last king of the Babylonian Empire. So the first and second kingdoms both are Babylon, according to this view. And then you've got Media-Persia, or Medo-Persia, as the third, and Greece as the fourth. Now, of the liberal views I've outlined for you, they all have something in common. They all want Greece, or the Grecian Empire, some point in the Grecian Empire, to be the last kingdom mentioned. Now, if that were so, what do we make of the stone that strikes the image in the feet? Obviously, we're told in Daniel 2:44 that it is in the days of these kings that the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. How are we to understand that if the fourth kingdom is the Grecian kingdom or is Alexander's successors? Well, I think most liberals would say that this stone may be an anticipated messianic kingdom that never materialized. It was, you know, reflective of the hopes of the Jews at the time when this was written, that they were living in the time when the Messiah's kingdom might arrive, and that it is in fact a reference to the messianic kingdom, but it just never materialized because their hopes were, they were off. They just didn't have it right. Of course, these people don't believe in inspiration of Scripture, so it doesn't matter to them whether it turns out to be right or wrong. It's just interesting old writings as far as they're concerned. Another view would take the stone to be the Maccabean revolt itself. In the end of the Grecian Empire, because of the sacrilege of Antiochus Epiphanes, there was an uprising, a general popular uprising, led by an older priest named Mattathias and his sons. And they did succeed in overthrowing the Greek powers in Palestine. They didn't conquer the Greek world, and they didn't try to. They just got Palestinian liberation from the Grecian power. And some would say, well, that stone represents their liberation and the God setting up a kingdom in the sense of liberating his people from the Greek power. Well, these views that I've just surveyed are not at all what the church throughout history has thought or what most evangelicals think today. I think that all of these views have some serious problems. The last view of Hitzig, where Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold and Belshazzar is the belly of silver, the principal problem with that is it's inconsistent. It makes the first two kings actual kings and the last two kingdoms. And it seems more likely that if any of them are individual kings, then they're all individual kings. If any of them are kingdoms, then all of them are probably kingdoms, just for the sake of consistency of the imagery. Well, as I said, all evangelicals have pretty much agreed that Babylon is the head of gold and that the Medo-Persian Empire is the chest of silver that came afterward. The belly of bronze is the Grecian Empire, which includes Alexander and his successors, until the time of the Roman conquest, and the Roman Empire is the fourth kingdom. On this view, of course, the stone that strikes the image in the feet is the kingdom of the Messiah. Now, on this last point, there is a divergence of opinion even among the most conservative evangelicals. It is at this point that the dispensational view differs from what has historically been believed by conservative evangelicals. I have in this chart, in the first column, or not column, but the first row of columns, the view of the early fathers, including Irenaeus and Origen and Eusebius and Hippolytus and Jerome and Augustine, as well as of the reformers Luther and Calvin, as well as of most evangelical scholars today who are not dispensational. And that is that the feet of iron and clay in this image simply refer to the decline of the Roman Empire historically. And then when it says in Daniel 2:44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, it is simply saying that in the days of the Roman Empire, God would set up his kingdom, and he did. It was in the days of the Roman Empire that Jesus came and established his kingdom, according to the view that most have held throughout history. Most Christians have held that view throughout history. It is also the view I hold. And I don't know what the breakdown would be of modern Christian evangelicals, how many hold one and how many hold another. I think dispensationalism today is extremely popular, and it may even be the majority view now of evangelicals. But the historic view has been that the feet of iron clay represent the breakdown in the strength of the Roman Empire and its final dissolving. It does not suggest that the Messiah would come after the kingdom of Rome had dissolved, but rather, on this view, the kingdom of the Messiah starts with Jesus, like a little stone, but it grows through evangelism, through the missionary efforts of the church. It grew and grew, and it finally replaced the Roman Empire, and it certainly did. Especially in the time of Constantine in the 4th century, the pagan Roman Empire was replaced by Christian emperors. And then eventually the Roman Empire dissolved altogether, but the kingdom of the Messiah continued and continues to this day. In fact, it is the principal interpretation of commentators throughout church history that what is being shown here to Daniel or to Nebuchadnezzar through Daniel is all of the world empires that will rule forever after Daniel's time and Nebuchadnezzar's time. There's the Babylonian was a world empire. The Medo-Persian was a world empire. The Grecian was a world empire. The Roman was a world empire. And the kingdom of the Messiah is a world empire. Now, the kingdom of the Messiah is distinguished from that of its predecessors in these words. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. Now, what this means is, unlike the Babylonian kingdom, which was destroyed and was left to others, namely the Medes and the Persians, and unlike the Medo-Persian kingdom, which was destroyed and was left to others, that is the Greeks, and unlike the Grecian kingdom, which was destroyed and was left to others, the Romans, the kingdom of the Messiah will not ever be destroyed and will never pass into history, and there'll be no successors to it. It'll never be left to others to replace it, because it will not need to be replaced. It says specifically, it will break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So the Messianic kingdom will be forever, and it will never be replaced. The historic view of, and in